Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on Syria, where the Assad dictatorship has just warned that the region will go up in flames if the regime is threatened by what it calls Western interference. A specialist on Syria, James Galvin, joins us to assess where the real opposition, the Syrian people, are heading in terms of armed resistance supplanting peaceful protest, since thousands of unarmed citizens have been killed by a regime that is prepared to cling to power at any cost. Then we'll be joined by former constitutional and civil rights litigator and contributing writer to Salon, Glenn Greenwald, the author of With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. We will discuss the two-tiered system of justice in this country that protects the powerful and punishes the powerless, and how the uprising by the 99% is the first step in reversing a complete takeover of America by oligarchs. And joining us now is James Galvin, who is a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his forthcoming book, From Modernization to Globalization, The United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And it seems that in an interview with the UK's Sunday Telegraph newspaper, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has warned of an earthquake if the West intervenes in his country, which the West is intervening is apparently dubious and certainly being exaggerated on his part. I mean, most Western observers and would, I think, argue that the West hasn't intervened enough, that he's that Assad is able to go and murder his own people unabated. However, what was implied in what Assad was saying is that the country will be turned into another Afghanistan, and that the whole region, Syria is the hub now in this region. It is the fault line. If you play with the ground, you will cause an earthquake. Any problem in Syria will burn the whole region. So is this what he's saying now, is that he's saying, if you bring me down, I'll bring the whole house down?
Well, I think it's slightly different from that. I think what he's, number one, what he's saying is he's making a warning. He's always presented what's going on in Syria as either something that is between the Syrian people and Salafis, radical Islamists on the one hand, or gangs, and also between Syria and foreign intervention. At various points, it's been the Americans, it's been the Israelis, it's been the Saudis, it's been a whole variety of groupings. It's actually interesting to have a conspiracy that consists of both the Israelis, the Saudis, and the Palestinians at the same time. Nevertheless, he's tried to juggle that one as well. So it's one of those things where right now what he is attempting to do is to maintain his credibility in terms of being at the forefront of the anti-imperialist alliance, as he puts it, against the Americans, against the Saudis, who are the lapdogs of the Americans, against the Israelis, and so on and so forth.
Well, but isn't the from the very beginning when this outbreak, which I guess is obviously in obviously affected by the broader issues in the Middle East, and particularly the rise of the Arab Spring. It started in the most working class of towns, Diriyah, on the border with Lebanon, and it spread throughout the country. And it seems entirely to do with the Syrian people being fed up with over 40 years of this family who think they own the damn place.
Oh, you're absolutely right. The spark that set off the rebellion in Dara, it was the arrest of school children who had been writing graffiti, anti-regime graffiti, that had been borrowed, actually. The slogans had been borrowed from the Egyptian uprising. They were arrested. The parents tried to get them out of jail. It took 2 weeks. They still couldn't get them out. They were tortured while in jail. And the parents went out on the streets. That was it. You know, a week before this occurred, social networking-type youth in Damascus were unable to get more than 350 people out in a demonstration. once this thing occurred in Daraa, once the police once fired on the crowd in Daraa, you had 20,000 people out on the street of the small town, small border town, which is not nearly the size of the larger towns that right now are involved in the sort of uprising, like Homs and Hama.
Well, it spread, and it apparently the more Bashar al-Assad and his son, his brother Maher, who runs the 4th Division and the Republican Guard, who are doing most of the killing, it's sectarian in the sense that the Alawite regime that the Assad family represents, 15% of the country, it's a Shia, it's a branch of Shiism, and they control the military, they control the intelligence service, and they basically have locked down the entire military. But they've killed at least 3,000. You could, who knows what the real figure is? Most of the Syrian activists say it's much, much higher than that. And the more they kill, it seems the more that they bring the people out. I'm trying to get a sense of that dynamic because, you know, in our earlier hour, James Galvin, we were essentially talking about how maybe the people in this country are waking up in terms of the 99% movement. But we, you know, our politics are pretty pathetic and pretty passive, and you can't even get people to vote. These people are literally risking their lives. They're going out facing tanks and machine guns and the most brutal, heartless people who are literally prepared to, you know, they kill them at funerals, for God's sake.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, there are two things that I found astonishing about this uprising in Syria. The first one is the fact that the regime, in spite of being two steps behind every instance, has been able to maintain itself. The second one is the incredible heroism of the people who know what they're going to, what they're in store for when they go out on the streets. They develop tactics, for example, in order to get around what the government does. For example, they plan demonstrations for night so that government snipers are less likely to be able to pick them off one by one. I mean, things like that. So it really is absolutely astonishing watching what's going on there. The regime has said over and over again that it will not show any mercy to these gangs and Salafists and foreign agents that are supposedly the ones behind it. And the regime has not shown any mercy.
Well, it seems, though, that it's morphing into an armed struggle because people simply can't you peacefully demonstrate, they'll shoot you down. So obviously people are thinking, well, you know, we've got to arm ourselves. And apparently there have been some defections from the military, even though the Alawite officer corps controls the military and has locked down the army largely. There looks like there have been a number of deserters have managed to get away with some arms. And I'm wondering now that the Turks are offering a kind of safe haven inside their territory in the north of Syria, whether we're going to have a situation where you're going to have cross-border infiltration and you know, arms seeping in from Lebanon, from Iraq, where there's a lot of sympathy in the Anbar province, the Sunni areas, and from Turkey.
Yes, it's already been happening. Whereas you have people from the military defecting with their arms, you also have people from the military defecting without arms. And it's been the smuggling over the borders that has enabled the armed resistance to begin and actually accelerate. What we're seeing over time is a movement that was very flexible, unorganized, and peaceful. It's now settling into something very, very different. It's settling now into a sectarian conflict, and it's settling into a armed conflict. Now, of course, this couldn't be helped. I mean, at the very beginning, Bashar al-Assad said that this is what it was. This is how he was identifying it, sectarianism and through violence. But by maintaining the brutal repression, forcing or attempting to force Sunni conscripts to fire on their countrymen, what he's actually been able to do is to make it into a sectarian conflict, make it into an armed conflict. And so it was like a self-fulfilling prophecy there on his part.
Again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA. He's a specialist on Syria. And we're talking about warnings and threats that the besieged dictator of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, family that had been running the country for what, for 43, is it, 42 years? I can't...
Hafez al-Assad came to power in 1970.
Well, I can't do the math right now, but it's a long time, right?
Yeah.
And there, the Arab League are meeting now in Qatar with Syrian members of the Syrian opposition and in the government. And the Chinese have issued public warnings. The Middle East envoy said that the situation cannot continue, call for Assad to respect and respond to the aspirations and rightful demands of the Syrian people. And even the Iranian regime, or at least a part of the Iranian regime, has criticized the Assad's handling of it. So, what's happening on the diplomatic front? Because the reality is that my understanding is, in spite of what Assad is saying, that the foreigners are interfering. That they're not. This is not another Libya, and there's no calls for. In fact, the opposition are calling for a no-fly zone, but there's nothing on the table, is there, in terms of Western interference?
No, there really isn't. There's several things that we have to look at. First of all, Libya was a perfect setup for a no-fly zone. It's a desert country. The cities are all in a line along the Mediterranean coast, and you could actually do something from the air. Syria is very, very different. It's a mountainous area. It's forested. It's not the sort of thing that you would want to try to enforce a no-fly zone over. There's that. What they're going for is, what the opposition is going for, is they think that if there is a no-fly zone, it's very, very possible that defections of people with military equipment will begin, tanks, armored personnel carriers, that sort of thing. That's what they're hoping for. If there is not a no-fly zone, then those defections could not take place because the Syrian Air Force could, of course, bomb any defectors from the air. So they're looking at it in that way. There is absolutely no reception for that in the West at this time. The United States is not going to intervene in Syria for a variety of reasons. But there's a great deal of pressure now being put on the Assad government to back off, on the one hand, and to enter into the national dialogue that the opposition is calling for. The national dialogue is the weeny way that the Americans have been going for every single one of these uprisings that have taken place since the Egyptian one. The idea that you could sit down with the opposition and hammer something out. The idea that maybe Bashar al-Assad could compromise in a way that would not continue the bloodletting and so on and so forth. It's not a real effective solution.
Well, if these talks, are they people that are talking in Qatar with the Arab League that represent the Syrian opposition? Do they really represent the Syrian opposition? Because Assad has his kind of token opposition that, as kind of tools, doesn't he?
Yes. First of all, the opposition is very disparate. It consists of a whole variety of political groupings, including the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, including the people that we associate with the uprisings, the human rights and pro-democracy groupings, including some, people from ethnic minorities like the Kurds and so on and so forth. It's very, very disparate. The fact that they've been able to get together at all is surprising. It's not surprising that they haven't been able to really pull together a very, very strong united voice because they are so different from each other in their aspirations. So there are members of the opposition who are seeking reform. There are other members of the opposition who are saying that the regime right now has too much blood on its hands to even sit down and attempt to talk to. And then there are others as well who just don't want to get sucked into this thing because they view it as, number one, a way that the regime will try to split the opposition, number two, a way that the regime can continue to stall while it continues to crack down on the opposition, and they also see that the regime, it's impossible for the regime to heal itself.
So, I don't understand I've never understood why the U.S. has been so cautious about this situation, and the Israelis too, in spite of Assad saying that it's that there are foreign powers intervening, and he obviously refers to both the United States and Israel. I don't think there's any evidence that they are. Now, what's happening in terms of the squeezing the business class, who the nomenklatura, I mean, the people that demonstrate for in the pro-government people, are a lot of them are just government workers in, who are told to come out and demonstrate, otherwise they won't get paid. You do have a financial elite that's largely controlled by the family. They've stolen most of it, but I guess there's some trickle-down operating. There have been some sanctions on the export of oil, but my understanding is that Shell Oil hasn't come on board to really put the squeeze on. Is that true?
Well, oil is a sector that is fairly isolated from other sectors of the economy. And the money from oil, of course, goes directly into the government's hands.
Which means it goes into the family's hands.
Right.
There's
right.
no distinction
and,
between
but it's
them.
Not just the family, because you know what we have is one of the reasons this family has been able to hold on for as long as it has been.
42 years.
Yep. Okay.
I did the math.
It does cross sectarian alliances as well as intra-sectarian power grab. So what you have is at the heart of the regime, you have an Alawite religious minority, many of them linked also in terms of kinship ties. And then spreading out from that, they've been able to build bridges to, for example, both the Christian and the Sunni merchant classes. And those bridges have allowed them to maintain, let's say, a broader base than one would expect from just a single minority sect ruling. Look at it this way. In 1982, the Muslim Brotherhood of Syria staged an uprising in the city of Hama. People focus on the bloodthirstiness of the regime in putting down that uprising. I mean, that was it really was bloodthirsty. They just shelled the city from the outside. But what people should also focus on is the fact that in spite of the uprising, in spite of the fact that the regime was a minority regime, nobody else went out. In other words, the city of Hama was the rebellion was isolated to the city of Hama. That, for example, elites among in the Sunni community in Damascus and Aleppo decided that they were going to side with the regime against the Brotherhood. So they have been fairly effective, the regime, in building this cross-sectarian alliance.
Right, but when Assad took over and his brother, who lives very comfortably in London, I might add, who was responsible for the massacre in Hama of something like 20,000 to 30,000 people, that was a period, of course, when things were very tense with Israel, right? With the Yom Kippur War took place shortly around the same time, didn't it?
Well, it took place about 10 years before. Yeah. It was very tense with Israel because it was the invasion of Lebanon.
Sorry, that's what was going on. Yeah.
In 1982.
Right.
But there was something else in the wider area that was going on as well, which we haven't seen much of recently, which is in the 1980s. The 1980s was the decade of Islamist violence. We're not talking al-Qaeda here. We're talking about organized Islamist parties that tried to overthrow the various governments in the region. The effectiveness of these governments in putting that down cannot be overstated. I mean, at this point, for example, most of the large parties that we have, Islamist parties throughout the Middle East, have either committed themselves to working within the system or have dropped out of politics altogether. We don't have the same sort of armed rebellions that we had, for example, in Egypt or in Syria or throughout the region during the 1980s.
But my understanding, though, is that this situation now with Syria and with Assad sort of basically warning that he'll tear the whole region apart if he goes down, would it be in response to the fact that to some extent it is a surrogate war? If the U.S. and Israel are sort of taking a hands off because they don't quite know what to do and they're probably afraid that an Islamist regime may end up running the place, Nevertheless, the Saudis have made it clear whose side they're on, and they're on the side of the rebellion. The Iranians have made it real clear whose side they're on. They're on the side of the Assad, so they've propped them up with billions in cash, and they've sent in their Revolutionary Guard units to help them beat up the people and kill the people, and also control the internet, which is apparently the Iranian IRGC learned from crushing the Velvet Revolution. They learned how to frustrate attempts at social networking that were so successful in the Egyptian uprising. And that seems to be what's going on in Syria. So how far are we already in terms of a surrogate war? And I would think with the Turks offering a safe haven for the military defectors and people that are escaping from Assad, you've got Saudis, obviously they can spend any amounts of money on arms, etc. Isn't this thing shaping into a kind of surrogate war?
I think there might be another way of looking at it, which is that part of the Iranian government has come out and condemned the Assads for what they're doing. The Chinese have done this. The Saudis have done this. None of these governments are particularly interested in human rights or democracy. They're hedging their bets. They don't know quite which way it's going to fall. They don't want to sever their ties with the Syrian government should they come out strongly on the side of Assad, for example, and Assad subsequently falls to some sort of organized opposition. So what they're trying to do now is they're trying to figure out exactly where to go with a foot in both camps. So they're warning Assad against the brutality, against crushing the rebellion. They're warning Assad about, perhaps moving towards the Syrian National Council and recognizing that as a potential government. But at the same time, they're not going to take active steps. The most active thing that has gone on right now has been what's going on with Turkey and providing a safe haven for military deserters. We don't know how far that's going to go, though, what the Turks are liable to do in those terms. For example, very early on, there was large-scale refugee movement into Turkey from Syria, and the Turks had a very, very, they made sure that, first of all, that the Syrians would be isolated on the border, maintain themselves on the border, not be able to move into Turkey in any real depth whatsoever. And they also kept them away from surrounding villages in southern Turkey as well. So we don't know exactly what they're trying to do, whether or not, for example, they're using this as a lever, a threat against the Syrian regime, or whether or not they're actually going to allow, for example, cross-border raids to take place.
Well, James Gelvin, I thank you for joining us and filling us in. It seems to me that this is the next showdown, if you will, now that Libya's over, and I'm sure I know the Libyan opposition is saying that now that Gaddafi's gone, you're next, Bashar. And it does feel like it's turning into the very thing that that Assad warned about.
Right. The one thing, just very, very briefly, the ending in Libya is not going to be the Syrian ending. Libya split. Every institution, the military, for example, between the opposition and the government. In Syria, it's not going to work that way. If the army continues its defections, it's not going to come from the officer corps. The officer corps is not going to split. It's going to be the head and the body. The body's going to split off from the head.
I thank you for joining us,
James
Gelvin. Again, I've been speaking with James Gelvin, professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, and the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and a forthcoming book, From Modernization to Globalization, The United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment and joined by Glenn Greenwald.
يا بشار يلا علي يا بشار ويا بشار ويا قصاب وتضرب